Hello, friends. Kyle Tierman here, coming to you from sunny Los Angeles, California. There is a small south swell in the water, about 1 feet at 16 seconds. Not really hitting too many of the waves here, but if you are down south, maybe in the Central America part of the world, you are probably scoring some very fun waves today, but not here in Los Angeles, California, because you kind of got to travel to get good waves if you're living in LA, if I'm being honest. But it's beautiful for a lot of other things. Beautiful for a lot of other things. Damn good spearfishing here. Damn good people. And it's the most creative place in America. Got to say, I've never lived anywhere where you run into so many people just working on ideas, though, just chiseling away, chipping away at the next idea. Which I really enjoy, at least for now. I'm digging it. Got a good house situation. Got some fun housemates again. It's the first time I've lived with housemates in like 4 years. Because I was up in Santa Cruz. And I lived in this spot with housemates forever. It's a little surf shack. Paid fucking nothing for rent. It was incredible. And then I moved into my RV. And I lived in my RV, Starflight. Love Starflight. She's still going strong. Just did a maintenance check. Got the roof fixed. There were a couple leaks. But the old girl is still rolling steady. But anyway, I lived in Starflight for fucking 2 or 3 years. And that's just a small little space. Two years in Starflight. Then moved to LA and for almost 2 years I was in this little casita studio living by myself. So it's the first time I've lived with other people. You go down and like you're in the kitchen and you go get coffee and there's like someone else drinking coffee and you're like, hey, human, this is mighty early to be seeing other humans. So just want to let you know that you're in my space, but I guess I'm in your space and we're living together. So we may as well just make this work. And then we're hugging it out. And within like 30 seconds, we're fucking laughing. We're talking about sweet projects, what we're excited about. Humans are social creatures. And despite my best intentions, I think that I'm a social creature too. So I'm really digging, living with these people. Maybe I'll even have them on the podcast. Ooh, there's an idea. So life's good. I hope you're all doing well too. Hope the universe is being kind to you this month. The book I'm recommending, is The Psychology of Money. And I think it's just a damn good, damn thoughtful read. It's quick. It's a zippy read. And this guy, Morgan Housel, is a phenomenal writer. Here's a paragraph from it. The premise of this book is that doing well with money has little to do with how smart you are and a lot to do with how you behave. And behavior is hard to teach, even to really smart people. So for dum-dums like me, I like ideas like that because I want to do better with money. And this book is teaching me how. So The Psychology of Money, that's what I'm recommending to you. And thank you to everyone who has gone over to my Substack newsletter. If you would enjoy getting a Friday newsletter from me, just a quick little something. It's a new word every week that I incorporate into a humorous paragraph. And the whole intention of it is to teach new words, learn new words, have some fun. You can head over to tierman.substack.com or click the link below. That's also where I post all these podcasts. So if you have comments on this podcast, head over there and let me know what you think. Let me know who else you think I should get on. Connect with me. I will do my best to respond. This episode is with Madam Gandhi. And it was a pretty fun one. not going to lie. Madame Gandhi is an award-winning artist and activist known for her uplifting, percussive electronic music and positive message about gender liberation and personal power. She began producing music in 2015 after her story running the London Marathon Free Bleeding to combat menstrual stigma went viral around the world. She's been listed as Forbes 30 Under 30 in music, and her 2020 TED Talk about conscious music consumption has been viewed over a million times. Waiting for Me, shot in Mumbai, India, won the Music Video Jury Award at South by Southwest Film Festival in 2021, and her 100% organically sourced and sound MANA Nature Sound Pack won the New Wave Award at the 2021 Splice Awards. Her third studio album, Vibrations, was released in 2022, following the release of her previous albums, Voices and Visions. In June of 2022, Gandhi completed a master's in music science and technology at Stanford University's CCRMA, where she spent time in Antarctica sampling the sound of glaciers melting to create empathy and awareness around climate change. Please welcome to the podcast, Madame Gandhi.
Kyle Cameron here. I'm in Cape Town.
I was the only journalist in northern Nigeria.
Not an adventure until you get lost in Tijuana.
You get caught inside by a giant wave, you feel really alone.
I love the adventure of waking up and not knowing what will happen and that being my job.
I'm standing at a desert oasis right now.
A lot of tourists don't see this part of Bali.
Smiles and thumbs up.
Welcome to
polar plunging in Antarctica.
That's the one.
Tell me about that.
When I was a kid, even getting into a pool was a challenge. You know, everyone would jump in with so much ease and I would be like dipping one toe at a time and even avoiding the water. I also had like a mild fear of sharks, and yet all I wanted to do was be in the water. And so over time, between surfing and between taking ice baths, you know, practicing the Wim Hof method, there were so many different modalities that I was calling in to conquer that fear and fall in love with the thing on the other side. And specifically with cold, I love that bone to skin, inside to the outside feeling. It's so empowering. And I think where I really transcended it was doing my yoga teacher training last year in Costa Rica, my 200 hour. Because after 2 hours of yoga in the morning with Jonah Kest and Andrew Seeley, who I know are big fans of Mudwater as well, you know, I would sit for the polar plunge. And what we would do is cheer each other on. And because I'm a musician, you know, other people were using songs. And then one day I came down and a bunch of my classmates were using my music for the polar plunge.
You're like, this is the highest honor.
It was the highest honor. And it just showed me how we're all connected. Like my own music is helping somebody else with their own fear, which was a fear that I needed to get over myself. And so sometimes our own, you know, healing comes back and finds us. And so now sometimes when I do a polar plunge, I'm sitting there like rapping through my own songs or singing yes. my own lyrics, you know, getting through 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 4 minutes. I think the longest I've done was 7 minutes. That was last year in Bali. And then yes, this year I had the honor of traveling out to Antarctica with Daybreaker, you know, the morning dance party squad.
Right.
And which is where I connected with Mudwater, you know, and Jordan Chu and the whole squad.
Yeah, and tell people about Daybreaker who don't know about
Absolutely.
This.
Absolutely.
It's awesome.
It's super awesome. It's super important. You know, when I was living in New York City, I'm a born and raised New Yorker, grew up in Manhattan in 2014, 2015, I would drum at these Daybreaker parties. The idea is we love dancing, we love being out with our friends, we love being in our bodies, we love music, but maybe we don't love the drinking and we don't love being out at night and throwing off our body cycles, and we don't love potentially the shady hitting on energy that women specifically tend to get, you know, when we're out and about. And so the folks and my friends over at Daybreaker started a morning dance party where 6 to 7 a.m. you're in a nightclub setting doing yoga with incredible people and community. And then 7 to 9 is a total, you know, dance party. And I think the best has been discovering incredible wellness brands who sponsor the morning beverage, whether it's Mudwater or whomever else. You know, the other day I performed at the Wisdom in downtown Los Angeles for Daybreaker.
I've been to a Daybreaker there. Yep. It's so cool.
It's magical. And they were serving, you know, plant-based ashwagandha, you know, gluten-free vegan pancakes. You know, so I love discovering all the new stuff. And specifically with Antarctica, we went out to Antarctica and I just graduated from a master's in music science and technology at Stanford. And in Stanford, I was learning how to build underwater microphones, hydrophones, and recording the sounds of whales off Monterey Bay to sample into my electronic music. The sound of dolphins. My father owns a property in the Bahamas. Luckily enough, I was sampling the sound of dolphins, you know, with him. Sampling the sounds of just bubbles and movement underwater, a space that humans, we don't get to experience. And so when I went to Antarctica, I brought all my hydrophones with me, Kyle, and I would throw them off over the side of our small raft, what they called Zodiacs, and I was recording the sound of glaciers melting into the ocean. And when you listen to it, it's like this burst of life. It's like prana energy. It's bubbling, and it's a tragedy because it's literally the sound of our planet melting. And yet my thought is if I can sample this sound, which is natural and beautiful and tragic and emotive all at the same time, maybe there's an opportunity to use my music to create an opportunity for empathy. When we're listening to this, we feel moved to call to action, to change, to be better in our own habits. I myself have made so many changes in my own life, not ordering food unless they serve Tupperware, bringing my own Tupperware and my own mugs to places, making things at home instead of ordering out, reducing plastic waste. It's been a huge shift in my own life. So.
Yeah, you never know when you're going to be able to hook someone into the issue. Yes. And when it comes to something like whale sounds, there might be no greater sound in the world than whale calls. And
it's healing.
It's so remarkable. And also how the ocean is such a great transfer of energy, yes, whether it's swell energy or sound energy.
Yes.
It's this incredible conductor. For example, like if you just think about how far a whale call can go,
yes, and sound
in that
travels,
medium.
Sound travels faster underwater, that's right.
And it's all, whether it's a swell energy that's using that same kind of oscillation, mm-hmm, or whale calls, it's just, when you just think about these sonic sound waves that are,
yes,
moving all across the ocean. Just trippy to think
it is
about.
And it's healing for humans because that's the, you know, we were in the womb first and foremost, we were in water first and foremost, so those sounds and experiencing that kind of underwater heartbeat sensation is a very like homey, relaxing, safe feeling. And it's interesting because, like I mentioned, being in the water was a big source of fear for me for so many years. Like, I'm like, was I like a small fish who got eaten by a shark in a past life? And like, yeah, and I'm a Pisces, you know, and I'm like, is my whole, you know, job to like really get over my fear of water? And in the past couple of years, it's been so remarkable to be surfing, to be swimming. I think the next steps for me would be, you know, having to go scuba diving. I have a dear friend, Ewan, who keeps inviting me to swim with sharks. He leads a big expedition each year to swim with sharks. I think that would be like my apex, but I'm not fully there yet.
Well, it's a good, it's cool that you have that outlook where you're afraid of the ocean and your thought is, maybe it's not your first thought, but is it my job
to go deeper,
100%. And get through this rather than just avoid it?
Absolutely. And anyone listening, that's the key. Anything that is a fear is the biggest gift. It's revealing something that needs attention, needs work to make us super powerful. For the longest time, I would cry. I would journal. I want to be vegan. I want to have no coffee, no alcohol, gluten free. These are always my aspirations. 2013, you'll see my journal. 2016, you'll see my journal. 2018, and then the pandemic was that opportunity. Boom, 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 boom. And now it's been over 2 years. Like, just these five things are out of my life, and there was always a fear of like, oh, but I'm kind of addicted to these things, or I super want these things, or I can never live a life without these things. And then you just boom, superpower ninja style. And I think the feeling of overcoming a fear and being so strong with it is the thing that builds up my personal self-confidence, my personal sense of self-love, my personal sense of self-trust, and then being a safe energy for other people, because I'm like, nope, this is something that I can handle and that I can do and that I can show up with, and therefore I can show up for you with nice, happy, joyful energy because I've worked on these things that at one point were challenging for me. It's so empowering.
Do you have a process? You mentioned journaling. To identify the fear and then work through it. Do you have any kind of methodical way that you tackle something that you're afraid of?
Yes. I think for me, my fears manifest very physically in my belly, in my gut. So I have like a stomach anxiety. And so I, you know, for a while I was like, this is weird. I would just kind of ignore it. This is like 10 years ago when I was younger. Now I've started to fully say, okay, what is it? Like, I talk to her directly. What is it? What is it? What are you worried about? If I'm nervous for a meeting, okay, what is the nerve? Okay, I'm worried about this, this, this. Then what it does, it brings awareness. So yes, it is. I mean, I do my morning pages, three pages every morning.
Oh, you do?
I do.
That's so great. For people who don't know, morning pages is very powerful for kickstarting creative energy.
It is. You know, for me, it's combination. I do it before the, I make my matcha mud water. This is my ritual.
I like it.
And then I'm going to tell you about fears.
This is a damn good ad.
So my, it's the truth though. It's the truth. First of all, like for example, coffee doesn't go with meditation. If you have a coffee and then try to sit for meditation, it's like trying to set yourself up for failure. You know, I feel that way. Whereas if I make a little bit of a matcha mud water, not to say that there's no caffeine, but of course, as we know, it's a more zen caffeine. So it creates this really like light focus that I love. So I'll make myself a matcha mud water. I'll sit for my 3 pages of free form writing. And so morning pages is like there's no right answer. No one's reading it. You may never even come back to it. It's dumping the monkey mind onto the pages. And I really believe in it because it just goes shoop, 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 dump, dump, release, release, write whatever you want. Yesterday I had this for dinner. Yesterday I felt this type of way. This morning I'm feeling this. Today is my goals. Whatever random stuff. And then I sit for my meditation, you know, 10 to 20 minutes. And the reason why I do that is because you've now like sharpened the space for the meditation just a little bit more so by cleaning out the monkey mind. Then movement after the meditation, then shower, and then get after it for the day. And sometimes I do the movement first, then shower, then close it out with a meditation. Can go either way. You know, I've taken plenty of yoga classes in India where we start with meditation, then go into yoga. Sometimes the opposite, start with yoga, then conclude with meditation. I allow myself the freedom. And so then, yes, with fears, I notice if there's stomach anxiety, it's just information. And see, now, sadly, I drive all over LA and I see, oh, anxious, take weed, order this, order that, take this, CBD, this and that. Of course, America and capitalism will try to sell us everything under the roof. But the truth is, the real ninja bravery is to be joyful with the least amount of stuff and most amount of awareness. So if I'm feeling fear, anxious, I'm asking myself gently, what is it? What are you worried about? What is the fear? What's the worst that can happen? What is the old wound that's coming up? And this allows me to heal. This allows me to either tell the person directly. This allows me to navigate something that I think is a red flag. This allows me to soothe myself and remind myself this is an old fear that's not a reality anymore. And that's growth.
What you said about discomfort just being information is super important, because if you, I just period, I don't, there's no because, but I think that's really cool. And you will journal about that. If you feel discomfort, yes, you'll identify it and put it onto a page.
Yes, because then I'm going deeper into it. Also, a lot of my anxiety is like trapped, like sad energy. I feel that. It's like trapped negative energy, trapped like dark energy. And so sometimes, you know, especially if we as women, it's a blessing to have a cycle. Because I can see when I'm closer to my cycle, it's actually easier for me to cry it out and release some of that pain energy. And then I actually feel lighter. I feel better. A lot of us as women and folks who bleed, we're not taught that. But actually, it's a very useful thing to say, okay, I have hormones that will actually allow me to release this like pain and sadness a lot more productively, rather than it coming out in me being rude to the barista, rude to my partner, rude to my business team. You know, if I manage it privately, I actually show up joyful, happy, light, aware.
What will you do if you are feeling sad or you're feeling
moody
or yeah, teary?
Yeah.
How do you navigate those moods? This is a great conversation, by the way.
I'm so happy.
I'm excited to have it right now.
It's a
this
pleasure.
Cool.
It's a joy, because it's the truth and because you're an expert podcaster, so you creating a safe energy for me as well. So thank you. I think it's about... No, I've just practiced so many different things. I've noticed when I'm moody to somebody externally and I feel bad, and I also not even feel bad, it's like an out-of-body experience. I notice myself being rude. I feel like it's a bit out of my control, and I also feel like this is not me. This is not who I am. I know better. I want to lead with love, kindness, abundance, awareness. I like making other people feel good. So if I'm making somebody else feel bad, it's because I'm hurting. I'm feeling, you know, something is off. So the key is for us to manage and meet our own needs so that we show up in the world as the people we believe ourselves to be. And so yes, I think absolutely last year when I lived in Topanga and I had space in the pandemic, taking mushrooms, sitting for long meditations, learning what are the deeper downloads, you know, through these psychedelic experiences. I remember once after a big like crying and release, it felt so good. the download was, this pain is not your own. This pain is not your own. You know, my family has migrated through wars in India. My grandmother is Irish. She's seen plenty of, my ancestral trauma is absolutely there. You know, that's a word that gets thrown around, but I felt it. So then when we manage it responsibly, when we sob it out, when we journal, when we release it privately, then I feel ready to show up as a superhero again. So I think it's that. And one technique I've learned that I've developed myself is to just slowly ask myself, okay, Kieran, is it this? I don't feel loved. I don't feel beautiful. I don't feel sexy. I don't feel smart. I don't feel empowered. I don't, like, I just kind of like say random words to like see which one it might be. And then boom, one of them usually works. And I'm like, oh God, it's that, you know, and then I release it. And sometimes it's too vulnerable and too embarrassing. Like, even if it's making me cry, sometimes I don't even believe it. I'm like, yeah, I mean, I think I'm beautiful. I'm fine. Like, I don't feel that deep of a wound. But for whatever reason, I think we as women, we feel these like deeper emotions and we have to honor them rather than suppressing them.
I don't know if you have a niece, but let's say that you had an 11-year-old
niece. My partner has three girls. So yes, I have three of them.
Okay, so let's say that she's coming to you and she's asking you about how to navigate this. She doesn't have anyone else to kind of to talk about her cycles, the moods that can come with that, and how to see it as a power rather than
debilitating. Yes.
How would you navigate that conversation with her?
I love this question. I think that so often society has used this exact thing against us, and that's because we as women are not having enough conversations because it's been taboo for so many years. In 2015, I ran the London Marathon. I ran it free bleeding on my period, and you're smiling, so I know you know the story. And I ran it to combat this kind of shame and taboo that women and girls and trans folks and people who bleed all around the world, we face each month on our cycle. And the story went completely viral, starting this global conversation about how we treat menstruation in various cultures. And it was such an important part of my own feminist journey on a public scale, because always I had been a women's studies major, gender studies. I was always the kind of go-to feminist in my friend circles. And it gave me this opportunity to talk about these things in a much bigger way. And the moment I'm scoring a documentary called Periodical, my engineer Kevin and I in Oakland in our studio, we're scoring a beautiful documentary called Periodical for MSNBC. And in this documentary, they're addressing so many of these topics that just years ago were completely embarrassing, awkward, made fun of all this. So that's the first thing. I would like lay the groundwork for my 11-year-old. Okay, this is the, you know, mainstream situation that we all have to work towards. We're barely destigmatizing now. It's 2022. Luckily, the kids have Instagram and all these places to share. And then on a personal level, I would tell her, go deeper into your feelings. Find either friends or loved ones or myself who can hold you and love you through these difficult feelings, and you just cry it out. And the more you do it for yourself privately, the more you learn how to manage and meet your own needs instead of depending on other people, a boyfriend, a girlfriend, a mother, a lover, a teacher. Meeting our own needs is the best case scenario, because then you're not upset that somebody else can't help you. You've learned how to help you yourself. And then the second thing I would tell her, eat right, my babe. You gotta eat right. You gotta eat clean. You gotta eat aware. You got to be thoughtful of what you're putting in your body. You got to drink water. You got to stay active. You got to get some movement in. Are we running? Are we swimming? Are we boxing? Are we surfing? Are we snowboarding? What's the movement of the day? Are we Pelotoning? You know, what's the vibe? And then...
just a little closer.
Yes, of course.
Thanks.
Yes. Are we movement? And then rest, you know? Are we? And I always just go back to the basics. Can't go wrong. So those are some of the things. Manage your emotions. Manage the physical health, and then also be aware that it's still a bit of an uphill battle, that the patriarchal energy is still strong, that the oppression is still strong, and that we as women, through our own awareness and healing, are then teaching the rest of the planet.
I was doing some research on your marathon and raising awareness around this issue, and I didn't know that feminine hygiene products are still taxed as luxury items.
That's right.
Will you just give a little summary on where we are right now? Because I had no idea. So you educated me.
Yes, absolutely. So if you buy tampons, pads, menstrual cup, there's a big tax on these items, and it's called the luxury tax, which is quite unfair, because if we were all to just free bleed and not use any of these products, we wouldn't be the best case scenario. We'd have a lot of uncomfortable people, maybe not the most hygienic situation. I'm just being playful, but that's the far extreme. Fine, we won't buy your products, then what? And then on the other side, if you look at what else is taxed as a luxury, like not even what is it? Like, not even Viagra is taxed as a luxury.
Really?
Yeah.
Like, we need that.
Yeah. Yeah. And listen, I'm not saying that it should be taxed. I'm happy that people are enjoying their sex and sexuality freely. We want people of all ages to enjoy their sex and sexuality. We also want people who bleed to be comfortable and feel dignified when they're experiencing their cycle. So we have 22 states that still have the tampon tax. That's what it's called. Incredible people are still in the field tackling that. And the way I see activism work is that, you know, radical activism shocks the culture and the society into talking about something. Talking about something then creates awareness. Oh my gosh, I had no idea. That's crazy. That's terrible. I don't want that. Then politicians are able to say, vote for me if you don't want the tampon tax, because I'm going to work with Capitol Hill to abolish the tampon tax. Then the lawyers and the legal, the folks who are in that world can start advising as to how to recreate a world that we actually want to live in. So it's interesting. Sometimes people say, oh, radical feminist activism, or when they used to say, what good does running a marathon free bleeding do? It does quite a bit. It's the symbolism. It's the awareness. It's the virality. It's the conversation. It's the bravery. It's the badass. It's the inspiration. It's all of the different things that spark people into caring enough to then vote for folks who will make change on the ground. And so this is where we are with the tampon tax. The goal is for products to be affordable for all of us, to feel like, you know, someone who's dealing with food stamps doesn't have to choose between cereal or tampons. Not fair. We bleed and we need to eat, both and basic human needs. And I think each day we are moving towards a better world, a more aware world.
How did your parents teach you to think about activism?
Because both of my parents moved from India to New York City since we were kids. My younger brother and sister and I were always taught we have to give back. We've given you kids everything, nice education, nice home, nice life. You better be giving back since childhood. And it was not just giving back like write a check vibes. It was like we used to go to Asha Dan, which is in India, the orphanage of Mother Teresa. And as a kid, I remember feeling a bit scarred. You're seeing kids with lots of immune disorders, physical disabilities, you know, differently abled. And even as a kid, you're a bit scared. You're like, oh my gosh, like I didn't know what blindness looks like. I didn't know what it looks like to be 6 years old and have no left arm, things like that. But it was so vital that my parents showed us that and encouraged us to give love and care to these little kids. In India, you call kids babas. So my mom would say, shall we go and visit the babas today? And, you know, my brother and sister, I say, yes, let's go. We would read books. We would play with them. We would have fun. We would dance, you know, these kinds of things. So you're aware on the immediate front lines. And then you're also aware on like a larger global level. We grew up in the Upper East Side of Manhattan. We grew up in Eleanor Roosevelt's townhouse. And we would have guests like Hillary Clinton come to our house, guests like Tony and Cherie Blair, the former UK prime minister, and his partner come to our house. My parents would tell us, you know, in our pajamas when we were like in sixth grade, seventh grade, eighth grade, we'd have to read the introductions of these big state leaders, you know. And so from all angles, we were taught, we want you kids to be world leaders. We want you kids to make a difference. We want you kids to be volunteering and aware. And we also want you kids to understand that you can make change on a big level. I was encouraged to public speak. I used to win awards for public speaking as a third grader, you know. So it was by no accident. It's been very much instilled in our childhood.
Yeah, I think that exposing kids to people of different social classes is so, so damn important. And I noticed this theme with kids who are exposed to that. They just keep it in their awareness early on. It's like kids who are exposed to the outdoors early on. And they ask, well, how did you become a wilderness guide? You know, what got you into climbing? Well, we were taking camping trips early on. My mom started an organization in Santa Cruz where I grew up for homeless teens. It was called Above the Line.
Wow.
Years ago when I was just an infant, this 14-year-old walked up to her on the street and said, do you know anywhere where I might be able to sleep tonight? And she didn't know. So she looked around and learned that there were no homeless teen centers in our county.
Wow.
So she started one. And I remember growing up, she would take me around and we would, I would meet these teenagers who, you know, I was like 8, 9 years old, meeting these teenagers who I thought, we're like, whoa, you're cool.
So cool.
You're 16, you're 17.
Yep.
But then later realizing, whoa, that was a homeless kid.
Wow.
And I remember she always taught me when someone asks you for money, on the street. You don't need to give it to them, but you need to look them in the eye.
Love that. And I agree. Humanity, awareness, connection. I see you. I send you love. Yes.
Yeah, I think that that is, it does a huge amount, because as we get older, it's so easy to otherize people.
Yes.
I wrote this essay that I'm really proud of, called Sally Jones, You Better Watch Your Speed, for Trends with Benefits. And it was about this friendship that I made with this woman who didn't have a home, and she lived on Lincoln Street. But she was this voracious reader, and wow, she would always have these crime novels that she was reading.
What a badass.
And we just developed this sort of hilarious, like, book club style friendship. Love. And I think that it's an important thing to remember, that, like, when you see someone who doesn't have a house, it's not this group of people. They're all these various individuals who have their quirks and tend to lead, have pretty interesting stories,
yes,
as well. So that's my little
and there's an opportunity for empathy. You learned something. You were inspired, and she was inspired by you. That's the thing. I think sometimes we think, I don't know what we think, but the key is for heart-to-heart connections always. And the key is awareness. The key is constantly, instead of us being defensive about something we don't know, just be like a child. Oh, I had no idea. Now I know. Now I can do something. You know, I think a lot of times we also beat each other up, this whole cancel culture thing. I think there's space for nuance. Okay, you didn't know. Now you do know. Are you going to make a different choice? That's simple. Okay, you did something that you're not so proud of, that had damaging effects on society, on others. Now you do know. What are you going to do differently? And that's the kind of forgiveness we have to show for ourselves, you know? Okay, Kieran, you weren't thinking too much about plastic when you stay ordering out. You grew up in New York City. Y'all ordered out all day long, all the time. Now you do know. What are you going to do differently? You know, we have no time for guilt. Guilt is such a wasted emotion. Don't waste my time with your guilt. Do something. Great. Now you changed. Now you've done something differently. Now you're growing. And we have to give each other that space to grow. If someone keeps criticizing me, it makes me feel small. Doesn't make me feel motivated to change my behavior. Makes me feel set up to fail. But if someone says, Kieran, I like how you made that change. Good job. Same for even with specifically looking at, you can look at feminism, you can look at racism, you can look at homophobia, you can look at all these societal things. For me, it's just ignorance, lack of awareness, small-minded, lack of abundance, lack of love, all these different things.
How do you, or do you at all, see busyness as a form of oppression? And how do you keep busyness from taking over your life?
It's such a great question, because just 2-3 days ago, I sat for meditation and I was like, Kieran, what do you want? And I was like, peace, stillness. I was like, bro, I stay working. Like, I feel like I haven't had a moment to pause. This, like, it's that kind of end of the year, close it out strong hustle. And I'm tired. I am tired. Even these past 3 days, I've been recovering a little bit, staying in my beautiful friend's guest house in Venice. I found myself coming home early, sleeping, you know, resting. You'll have to, that peaked a little bit. You'll have to cut that.
You're
one.
You're good. Got the musician in the studio.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I'm like, that clipped. You'll have to, you know, Isotope RX that little section.
I don't speak that language, but
it's fine.
But thank you.
Just kidding. So I think you've already answered the question in the question, which is that busyness can serve as a distraction. It's our way of telling ourselves, but look, I've done so much, but look, you know, but look, I have self-worth and value, but look, my calendar's so full, I'm so important. It's a complete fallacy. You're absolutely right. It's egoic. I think the awareness is to be in service. The awareness is to move based on what lights you up. What feels awesome. I can't wait to sit with Kyle in the Mudwater podcast. I've been looking forward to this conversation. It's the truth. I got up early so that I can come ready to work with you today. That's key. If I feel like I don't really want to show up for the thing, I'm not really trying to do it, I've learned from that feeling. I don't say yes to those things anymore. That's key. The second is, one thing I learned from my mother, she would always say, I'm never too busy for you. You know, oh, my mom, I know you're busy. Oh, my goodness, I'm not busy at all. I'm completely available and free. And you know she's completely busy. But what she's saying is, I choose how I use my time. For you, you're my utmost priority. It's the most loving thing you can say. People email me all the time or text me, I know you're busy, but I'm not too busy for you. I choose to be there for you. So I think the key with busyness is making sure and pausing for reflection and making sure that everything is coming from the inside out.
What does that look like for you? You said saying no. describe a situation for me. You get a text. Someone's like, hey, can you do this thing? Or do you do it?
Yes. It's moving with integrity and honesty. And sometimes that can be, you know, it can isolate people. People can take it personally. But I know it's not about them. It's fully about me. Thursday night, I played a big show in the De Young Museum in San Francisco, Golden Gate Park. By the time the last drum was put away and I finally had a midnight taco and went to sleep, it was like 2:30 in the morning. My car came to pick me up at 4:30 in the morning to come to LA on Friday morning. That's only 2 hours of sleep. It was not enough. I landed in LA. I shot the entire day with Style Like You, which is a great platform on Instagram and YouTube. And then by the time Friday night came around, I had to cancel everything. There's no way I'm going out for this dinner, for that. And I just told the truth. This is my truth. I only slept 2 hours the night before. I had every intention of coming. I thought maybe I could pull it together and come, but it's not happening today. And in telling the truth, lo and behold, that same squad of people who I couldn't go to dinner with, they were all at Daybreaker the next morning anyway. Like, when you have a true, genuine desire to see somebody, even if you can't see them that night, you will see them when you meant to see them. I really believe that. Because I'm not avoiding, I'm not lying, I'm not weirdly trying to, like, say yes, but actually I don't want to hang with you shadily. It's just the truth. I'm just tired. I'm meeting my own needs so that when I do show up for you, I'm not depleted. I have nice energy to give. So moving from integrity.
I use the I wouldn't be great company
text. It's the truth.
But it is true, yeah. And it's something that we all need to navigate as people feel like they have ownership over our time, or people just have more access to us than they used to.
And the more we tell the truth, the more we inspire other folks to also tell the truth. I like when people are straight with me rather than being like shady, because I'm like, I don't get it. What's really up, you know? Also, the more I tell the truth, the more I find my needs are met. Oh, you're feeling tired. Oh my God, I know the best place for you to get a soup. Should I send a soup your way? Like, you know, like people end up showing up. But if you lie, now someone's either they feel it immediately or they now trying to solve your problem in the lie. That's not even the true thing. You know, I've been through all of this, and you learn and you evolve and you show up correct. And I feel excited to walk in integrity. That's one. And then the other one is before any opportunities, any text, any invitation even comes, you're sitting in your own meditation. And you're saying, Karen, what do you want? You're saying, Kyle, what do you want? You know, what do you want? What lights you up? What feels good? Okay, I want to call in some financial abundance because right now things are a little bit challenging. I want to call in some work that's on a big level because I feel like I have so much to offer. I also want to call in peace and stillness and family and cozy energy and only hanging with like my true heart to heart. It's not really in the moment for new business meeting type things. That's like a January energy, not really like a closing out the year energy, yeah. You know?
You mentioned that fear will manifest in your stomach.
Yes.
Where does I don't want to go to that thing energy?
It's funny. I'm actually so notoriously clear for that stuff. I have no like hesitation, no guilt. yeah I'm just notoriously clear. I actually get complimented on this all the time. I'm notoriously clear. I think when you're a performance introvert, you're like pro. Like I'd be so happy to just tuck into bed right now. I think I trust in the abundance of meeting people and the abundance of the right thing. Also, so many times when I've like not been able to show up for something, then I connect with that person down the line. And if they feel some type of way or feel mad that I couldn't come, that's definitely their baggage because I didn't come because of them. I came because of me. So, it's okay. If that upset you, no problem. If I'm not the person to hang with you, no problem. It's okay.
When you get up, you have your morning ritual. Do you tend to then, on a perfect day, get straight into creation? Or is there
I do. So I found out that my sweet spot is 2 to 8 p.m. for creating, studio days. Yeah. Because I like to do my 16-hour fast no matter. So I always eat my first meal at 1. Matcha, mud water, oat milk is like a little caloric vibe in the morning. That's lovely. And then I don't have any food until 1. So the days when I used to say I'll meet you at the studio at 12, anyway I'm always late because then I'm like trying to like DoorDash my fucking meal or eat at the restaurant or whatever it is. And so then I've learned in India they say aramse, peacefully, with relaxed energy. Aramse, arrive to the studio at 2 p.m. ready to do your work. So that's my sweet spot, 2 to 8, and then have like a nice sleep early, wind down energy. A little Palo Santo, a little red light, a little Chopra music, you know. close out for the day strong, that kind of thing. Wake up early, get after it the next morning. I really like the sunrise wake up. That's key. And on the days that I can't do it, I see the missing magic in my day. The meditation and sunrise go hand in hand. I will still sit for my meditation regardless of the time I wake up. But if I have it my way, you know, no traveling messing it up or late night shows that I get booked for, that's the sweet spot. And it's interesting because even with letting go of the drinking, even with calling in, getting up in the morning, sunrise vibes, I've noticed, I don't stay here announcing it on my social media, I'm sober and this and that. Also, I wouldn't use the word sober because I'm happy to sit for mushrooms. I'm happy to sit for things that open my expansion rather than dim my expansion. But I don't advertise that I don't drink anymore. I don't even advertise that I'm vegan. I don't advertise that I want to wake up early. It just energetically, these are the kinds of things that I get booked for. I get booked for the things where they're like serving mud water and fucking kombucha, yeah. You know?
They're like, we know.
We know, we yeah. Know. And so I think when you're walking in your true integrity and it's every day, I do believe that we as humans are quite perceptive of each other. We understand what each other are about. And I like being received as a genuine, safe, loving, like nice energy for other people to anchor into.
You mentioned that sometimes people will have their own stuff if you're not getting back to them.
Yes.
Or you can't
yes.
get to them, you don't want to go to their thing. How do you think about letting go of friendships?
I think first I analyze it, which is actually my bad. First, I give a genuine analysis. Okay, like where is it my bad? What could I have done better? Because you obviously feeling upset. So let me control my 50% of the energy. So then I'll think, could I have told you sooner? Did I say yes, but I didn't really mean it? I just try to, because then I can learn. Because I'm not trying to let other people down or burn friendships. I have love for all my people. If you're in my life, I love you. So I first try to like take full responsibility and like identify where is my bad. And then I just own it and say it. Yeah, you're so right. I can so see how that would have put off your event. I can so see how blah, blah, blah. I own it. And then the second thing is if, you know, they are cool after that, then the friendship is cool. And if they still sending like weird passive aggressive moody this and that, I just delete the text and keep it pushing. Archive it if it's in WhatsApp, you know, let it go. Because this moody energy doesn't belong to me. I love you. I've given you nice energy. I've acknowledged my mistakes. What else can I possibly do? I'm showing up fully. So that's that. And I'm telling you, like, not drinking, not smoking, none of these things. I don't even mean to mention it so many times, not as if I was not even that big of a drinker or smoker anyway. But you can just tell, like, when you're eating clean, when you're drinking water, when you're meditating, the channels are so clear. You can be honest. What is my bad and where is my work? And I'm so happy to receive this lesson. I'm so sorry for that mistake. I didn't mean it. I'm here to learn and grow. I won't make that mistake again. That's my promise to you. A real friendship says, okay, cool. Thank you for taking responsibility. Thanks for doing the work. Great. I too want to do the work. You know, we teach each other. Those are the kinds of friendships I want.
What lessons have you learned from surfing?
Oh my gosh. Patience, love, awareness, seeing the sun and the moon in the sky at the same time, seeing otters back, you know, in Malibu, like kicking on their back, dolphins and rainbows, taking a little bit of mushroom so you just gently a little bit more tapped in, connected to the rainbows, to the waves, like phew, heaven. Also, like, allowing time to fly by, like, 2-3 hours have gone, and you don't have a watch in the ocean. I mean, I could wear the Apple Watch, but I don't. You just present. You zen. And I think even with certain things, like running, that used to serve that for me, and I still go for my runs, but I constantly am seeking things that make me feel present. You know, back in the day, that was my biggest attraction to my drumming. I feel like I'm so present. Now, because I'm a good drummer, I can still think of 100 things while I'm drumming, you know, so it doesn't drop me in that same way that it used to. I think because surfing, I don't want to drown, and I really want to catch a wave, and then when you catch one, it feels so good. And you have to be present to catch that wave like nobody's business. Then, you know, the wave comes and goes. You got to be dialed in. You got to feel it. You got to not listen to how somebody else has taught you. Like, you have to listen to the lessons and the instruction, but at the end of the day, it's just me and the wave. I got to feel the wave and get after it. So these are the obvious life lessons: being present, grateful, aware, and zen.
What lessons did you learn from your time working with MIA?
one lesson that I learned is that she always has different band members working with her at different times. And so there's this kind of lack of entitlement. No one's guaranteed a spot in the band. It's just MIA. So if she wants to do a show completely alone, she can do that show. If she wants to hire a DJ, she'll hire. If she wants to hire me, the drummer, she'll hire. But no one is guaranteed a spot in the band. And the reason why I like that style is that it keeps everybody respectful, keeps a healthy boundary, keeps everybody working hard, keeps everybody wanting to contribute their best work. And it also allows her as an artist to be flexible and fluid with whatever is inspiring her and put that into that iteration of the project. I find myself doing the same thing in the Madame Gandhi project. I've had so many incredible iterations of my band, and I've then doubled down on the people who I really like and rotated out the folks who I didn't think were exactly the chemistry that I was desiring. And it's with all the love and respect, because there was no expectation that we were necessarily working together past this gig. So that's one big lesson that I learned. And I think you can argue the same with team building. You bring folks on, and of course you want to engage them for the long term. And if it's a good fit, then you talk about a bigger collaboration. But in the beginning, show me you got your best work. Nothing is entitled. Nothing is for sure.
Yeah, there's a line that I've heard in business, I think has a lot of wisdom in it, which is we're a team that feels like a family, not the other way around.
Right. I like that. I love that, because then there's humanity in business. And in fact, you know, I went to Harvard Business School while I was touring with MIA. So when you ask me these questions, I feel like when I was in it, I was literally like taking a HBS mentality and like applying it to being on the band.
Wow, of MIA. That's fascinating.
Yeah, I really was doing that, because, you know, Harvard Business School is notorious for producing like white collar criminals and things like that. So in the past couple of years, they've like really done an incredible job of pouring research and finance and resources into training emotional intelligence, training being a responsible member of society. And I really respected that training, because that was where I really lit up and did a lot of self-work. We would practice how to have difficult conversations with people, and we would be taught to lead with vulnerability. Hey, Kyle, my fear is that you'll never invite me onto the podcast again. But the truth is that I'm actually really not feeling too well this morning. And is there a chance we can do it in 2 weeks when I come back to LA? Let's say I couldn't make it on the podcast today. You are trained to communicate with the truth. I respect that. I love that. Whereas the old school kind of like archetypical boss is like, you're fired because of this, and I'm going to assert my domineering energy over you. And that misses the opportunity for real connection, real nuance, real awareness, and really motivating your teammates or the person you're leading to the end goal. So
was there any class or teacher who specifically taught you those kinds of emotional intelligence skills at Harvard?
No, of course. It's a required course. It's called Organizational Behavior Lead. Absolutely. Yeah.
Do you remember the teacher's name?
Yeah. Ryan Raffaelli. Yeah. He's a real sweetheart, and he's a musician himself. And he actually wrote my recommendation to get into Stanford to do my master's music science technology. Yeah.
Were there any other lessons that Ryan taught you that you?
Yeah, of course. I mean, there's so many that I use to this day. I mean, there was a big concept called Blue Ocean Strategy, which, you know, it just builds on our theme of the day of conquering your fear in the ocean. Surfer to surfer, you know. Blue Ocean Strategy is, you know, if you go into the Red Ocean, you're opening a restaurant. What are the typical things that you would compete along the lines of? Okay, quality of the food, pricing, location, staff, ambiance. Like most people, when they start a business, they are now trying to compete across all of the different things that a restaurant would typically have to compete along. And most of the time people fail because it's way too many things to have to think about, and you're not optimizing for one skill set and really honing in on that. Blue Ocean Strategy is, I'm not going to participate on those known things. I'm going to go into the unknown, and I'm going to create a completely different concept that plays by different rules. So that's a challenge, because you have to create the lane, then you have to be number one in that lane, and you've created the rules, and you're now trying to train a new behavior. You could argue Daybreaker is a perfect example of that. They had to create a concept, which is let's wake up at 6 a.m. and dance together, which doesn't exist, which no one wants to do and no one's interested in, and or theoretically, and then we're going to be the number one product in that market. And they did it. And now, even when I went to Daybreaker on Saturday, one of the biggest pieces of feedback I gave the two founders when we had brunch after the show was, I felt like it felt normal. It didn't even feel like this like wonderment that people used to feel. It's kind of like when people used to find out about Uber or Lyft. They'd be like, oh my God, did you know there's an app that will pick you up in 5 minutes and take you where you got to go? Now it's like normal life. Call an Uber and keep it moving. So there's a joy to that. So in the same way, many people don't want to deal with all that because it's a lot more work, a lot more creativity, a lot more tolls on your highs of emotional confidence and then lows of emotional depletion. But the reward is dynamic. Red ocean is possible because at least you know what you're competing against. So you can try to be the best at those different things. So depends on who you are. But I've always been a blue ocean, and to this day it has served me.
Are there any other lessons that you learned from Harvard that you are using in your music now?
Yes, absolutely. I would say one of the biggest ones is about defining value. I'll never forget this class, this lesson we learned in strategy class, where they talked about how there was two siblings in the kitchen. They're cooking a meal, a pie, whatever it is. And there's only one orange left, and they both turn. They both want the orange. Damn, who's going to get the orange for their recipe? They both need an orange. So the parent comes in and is like, enough fighting. The parent just cuts the orange in half and says, you take half, you take half. But the truth is that had they communicated and had they talked about what their needs were, they would have found that one sibling just needed the rind, just needed the peel of the orange, and the other sibling just needed the pulp, the inside, and that both siblings could have unlocked 100% of the full value that they both need given the situation. That was a huge lesson for me. It taught me that with a bit of communication and understanding the other person's motivations, is it possible for us to unlock greater value for all people? All people walk away happy from the deal, maximizing what's available to each of them. So how does this look? If I want to do a show, and I'm excited for the show, but the budget is like an embarrassment. Please, I'm not going to show up for this budget. No. But I might analyze it on other spectra. I might say, okay, but the photographs from this event would actually be gorgeous, and I really wanted to increase the portfolio of my stuff online. Or I really think the video from this could be excellent for me to beef up some of the stuff that I'm wanting to do. Or the people in this audience are very, very influential, and if I perform for this audience, it'll create future opportunity for myself. I'm just being honest. So then I can say to them, listen, keep your small budget. I'm okay with that. Where I really want value is this, this, this. Can you promise me that the footage can be delivered within 5 days and that you wouldn't mind editing something for my reel? Then I don't mind showing up. And either they can say, no, 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 we can't do all that. We just need a simple artist to show up and play. Or they'll say, yeah, of course. Great. Thank you so much. Okay, cool. This works for us. Does that work for you? So this is my dream. I love being creative in unlocking value for all people.
When you look back at your career up until this point, what have been decisions you have made, whether it's connections you've made, decisions you made, shows you played, that took you to the next level? Have there been any that stand out where you're like, that was a really good call that maybe didn't even show itself at the time?
Absolutely. I mean, of course, there's been many moments like that. I think one that comes to mind is actually a show that I'm going to be playing next week in San Francisco. Interestingly, there's when I went on Summit at Sea many years ago, I met the founder of this organization called Lesbians Who Tech. She basically, coming out of tech, felt like there wasn't a lot of solidarity around queer women, queer folks. So she started her own tech conference. She's like, dude, how can it be that all the like top CTOs and top marketing people are all queer folks, but yet they're not given the proper speaking platforms at South by Southwest and all these other tech places? So this conference grew and grew and grew. And in the early days, I would play it. And then off the back of that, they're like, head marketing person at Pandora would be like, come and speak at Pandora. And then the next person would be like, oh, I'm the such and such events coordinator at YouTube, and we're having this women's day show. Why don't you come be our dedicated speaker? So then I'm going to these top places, I'm playing my new music, and then lo and behold, the person at Spotify or Pandora or YouTube is now programming my music in the playlist rather than me submitting the thing online like every other artist desperate to get playlisting. I'm just going right to the source, and I'm getting paid to do it, and I'm influencing people in these high business environments. So it's like a win-win-win-win-win. And then when I showed up for Leanne's conference, I thought I'm doing her the favor. Lo and behold, it paid my bills and created influence and upped the quality and contribution I was able to make on a multidimensional level for the months to follow.
Damn good answer right there.
Thank you. It's true.
When you think about public speaking. You said that you got awards when you were in third grade.
Yeah, first and third.
First and third.
Let there be no confusion. Yeah, clap.
The highlight of my career.
It was.
Third, it's been a lovely ride downhill from there. Like, God damn, that third grade award. Do you remember any early lessons you got from about public speaking? You're so comfortable on stage now, but it's, you know, what did they say? Human's greatest fear isn't death, it's public speaking.
That's funny.
Do you have, let's say for this 11-year-old niece, you're talking to her again. What lessons would you give her for her first big public school talk in front of the school?
That's funny, because I was able to answer the question until you reframed it as advice that I'm giving to a small child. Because the interesting thing is that actually the real advice is you have to develop your own style. You have to develop your own style. Some people like to have a printed speech that they're going to read. Other people, you know, for me, it's always knowing the like three or four major themes I'm going to hit. And then I got to just be able to do it in real time presently. You know, I gave the graduation speech. I was the keynote graduation speaker at the Green School, which is this incredible eco-friendly, end-to-end sustainable school in Bali, Indonesia, for the graduating class of high school students 2019. And I felt so nervous. My heart was beating through my chest, because that's quite an honor to be the graduation speaker. It felt like a new level for me and the kinds of things I'm asked to do. And I think I also felt a very genuine responsibility. I'm these kids' graduation speaker for the rest of their life. I'm it. You know, Phoebe Buffay, Lisa Kudrow, was my graduation speaker, 2007 in Chapin in New York City. Cool thing to have her, but she was a terrible, you know, graduation speaker. She was so bad. Don't remember a single lesson.
Who is this woman?
She's Phoebe on Friends. Come on, Kyle.
I don't know this. I'm sorry.
You don't know what Friends is?
Oh, Phoebe on Friends. Yes, yes,
please,
yes.
Kyle.
Of course.
Yes.
Of course.
No confusion.
Yes.
Lisa Kudrow was our Lisa Kudrow was our graduation speaker, and everyone was so excited.
Exactly. Is that the one?
Yes, yeah, Smelly Cat. She had graduation speaker, and she was no good. She just talked about herself, but not in a way that's like a life lesson. She wasn't prepared. She just said whatever. She relied on her fame, and then she left, you know? And I'll never forget. I was like, what a missed opportunity. We were all so excited for you. So I think that's why it mattered to me that I did a good job. And by the time I actually gave the speech, parents came up to me and said, this is the best speech we've had. You know, the kids really received it. I felt so happy with how it went. It was a big success. And that's because I did that. I had my three or four anchoring points that I knew I wanted to make. And then I wove them in a way that was organic and present and referenced what was happening in real time, referenced the speech before me, referenced. And I think being present is one of the biggest things that I've learned in public speaking, because you can't go wrong if you're present. You can't go wrong if you're honest, if you're making eye contact, if you're owning the moment. When I was young, they would teach us to move, take up space. How great that they're teaching a young Indian American brown baby 8-year-old to take up space. Great. When do we teach kids that? They may make kids feel small, be quiet, sit in a corner, shush, you know? So that was a blessing. Take up space. Even to this day when I public speak, I prefer to move. I think the second thing was look at your audience. Look at them. Talk. The next thing was experimenting with slow and fast. We were also taught that. Speak slowly. Take pause. Especially when I do that now, that's when everyone stops looking at their phone. The second I pause on stage, everyone's like, oh shit, like what did I miss? Yeah. It's super effective.
Is she looking at me?
Yeah. Is she looking, exactly. Yeah. But it's interesting because I also feel if someone is on their phone, I actually take full responsibility. If you're on your phone scrolling through Instagram while I'm giving a public speech, I'm doing something wrong. I want full 100%, 100 out of 100, no one's on their phone. Everyone's here with us together. I see that as the responsibility of the performer or public speaker. So I enjoy it. I challenge accepted. None of y'all will be on your phones by the time I'm done with this speech. And most of the time, this is the truth. Not from an egoic, but from the space of that's our job as entertainers, to bring humans into the present moment and feel something collectively.
The magic of pausing and speaking slowly, too, is I remember I interviewed this guy named Van Jones years ago. You know who he is? Yeah,
of course.
Amazing public speaker. And I asked him a very similar question. Do you have any lessons? And he says, people think it's about what you say. It's the moments between what you say, because that gives the audience time to create the image in their mind.
Love. That's a great advice. Thank you for that.
Yeah. Do you remember the anchoring points that you made for your Bali speech?
Yes, I knew that I wanted to speak about moving from a place of being a kid who's studying what other people do into seeing myself as an agent for world change. Actually saying, okay, cool, I've learned this, this, and this. What am I going to do about it? Because otherwise, I think we can stay relying on the external. Like, we go from high school to then college to then a job. Like, very little. I always felt like everything was so pre-programmed, you know? And no one asked me, like, Kieran, what do you think? Or, like, even when I learned piano lessons, for example, I was always, given the homework assignment of come back knowing the song and now playing somebody else's music. No one, and they should have been, tasking me with the assignment of 8-year-old Kieran, 9-year-old Kieran, I want you to come back next week and write a song. That's what I should have been asked to do. Luckily, in school, I was asked to write a lot of poetry, which I draw inspiration from in my music today. But I was never asked to, like, play songs on piano. I was always given the homework assignment. So that was one anchor point. How do we move from a space of, like, taking in all this knowledge, and now you go do something about it? And then the second was definitely talking about that shift from the marathon story and stepping into my own power and running the marathon free bleeding and knowing that there was something powerful there. And sharing it with the world bravely, so, and believing in the truth of it. And then concluding with just kind of like a call to action, you know, yeah, like what are you gonna do? Like, what do you have to say about it? And again, interestingly enough, that's also a Harvard Business School thing, because for how oppressive and quite bro-y that it really is, I have to keep it 100. It's like the Harvard Business School is the breeding ground of the capitalist patriarchy. My father is teaching there now. He gets so mad when I say that because he is teaching social impact, you know, and he's very much like, we have to make a difference at the level of these big influential companies. And he's not wrong. We need everything.
Yeah. And both can be true, right? They can, as you say, there can be these great classes where you derive these insights and take them into your life, and there can still be a bro-y culture. Like, I think that it's not one or the other.
Right.
Which is what you're talking about with nuance.
Nuance, yeah. Yes, yes. And I think in that same space, the whole premise of the business school classroom, after each person has read the case and comes to class prepared, is what do you think? We're reading about the copper industry in Chile. None of us have any business commenting on the copper industry in Chile. And yet, each of us are graded on our opinion on the thing. So it's actually quite a profound skill set, which is a beautiful one that not enough of us are taught. Which is like, don't look left and right. Don't look up and down. Don't scroll on Instagram. Don't Google for the answer. What do you actually think?
It's a huge problem right now in the narrowing of our personalities to adhere to group mind. And I think that one skill that you're talking about is maybe the most important skill on planet Earth right now, because it's the antidote to tribalism.
I agree, and it's critical thinking, and it's a beautiful level of, like, questioning something to then improve it, not to destroy something necessarily unless it needs to be destroyed, but questioning to improve it and gentle pushing in the right direction.
When you are getting involved in whether it's an issue or you're deciding your opinion about something that has come into your life, do you have any kind of practices to try and adopt the other perspective?
Absolutely.
Or you're like, let's talk about this a bit, because I think it's really easy to just glob onto a new opinion that you learned 10 minutes ago, and then all of a sudden it's part of your identity, and then you actually don't even oftentimes have a very strong argument because you've never inhabited the opposition's argument.
Love.
But do you have any kind of practices or examples where you will think about it from various perspectives? You know, take the position of all of the blind mice, so to speak, trying to describe the elephant.
Love this. I think what comes to mind is a 12 Angry Men moment, where it's like you're trying to get unanimous vote on something, and you have to convince each other of what's going to be the final decision. And that's, again, another business school reference. And it's funny because business school was 7 years ago, and yet those lessons, the ones that resonated, stay strong. Which goes back to something that you and I talked about before we hit record on the podcast today, which is how do we pull different levers at different moments to get the desired outcome that we seek? And one of the biggest ones is just gently asking questions and asking them sincerely. We've all been asked a question where the other person already has their opinion and they're being very like passive aggressive.
Yeah, no, I'm curious to know. You're curious. No, you're not. You're just giving me a line.
You're giving me a hard time and you're not coming at me with a genuine intention to connect, understand, learn. And we can all tell. So if you're not in a place to readily be genuine, then don't show up until you are. I really believe that. But if you are being genuine, you can sincerely say, I don't understand this. Why would da-da-da-da-da? I don't understand this. Why? Why would the Iranian regime be so violently trying to keep women in hijab? Why? Okay, power, control, money, oppression. But even it's always interesting for me to go deeper. Well, what's the history? Was there a time when those same people who are now the oppressors were so blatantly oppressed themselves that now they are clinging to an old mindset out of their own fear, out of their own trauma? Everything comes from these places. Sometimes you can say that empathy is enabling. People say, no, don't show so much empathy. You're enabling bad behavior. I understand that mentality, and I think to a certain extent, if those people who you're extending that empathy to are not showing responsible change in their actions, I see where that can be problematic. But I always think empathy is our greatest friend because it gives us an understanding of the tools that are needed to tackle and change the thing as it exists. And, you know, right now there's incredible protests happening all over the world to combat the oppressive tactics that Iran has always used against its own women, its own people. And more so than ever, the men are showing up, which is really, really different and really, really powerful. Because oftentimes it falsely gave the illusion that it benefits men to keep women suppressed. False illusion. We're all waking up to the fact that we all should be thriving beings to the fullest of our humanity. That's how we benefit each other. And I think the awareness that's coming from social media, pushing people forward, is a big one. Now, that's just one example. But I think that when we understand where another person's actions are coming from, it gives opportunity to think creatively about the solution rather than small-minded of what we think the solution should be.
You mentioned history, and as you're learning about an issue, looking back, I have a friend who, bit of a mentor to me, and he spent years in Spain, and he was teaching English class to Spanish kids. And at one point, he was teaching a history class, and he said, "You all like soccer, right? Football in Spain." He's like, "You all like, right?" So he said, "How much would you like the game if you didn't understand the rules? History is the rules of our world."
Wow.
And I think that is, I like looking at history through that lens, and it's not something, oh, it's just snooze fest, I've got to listen to it. It's information. You're learning about the rules. You're learning about how humans have behaved in the past.
And the motivation.
And the motivation. And guess what? We still have the brains and bodies of our ancestors, you know, hundreds of thousands of years ago. So using that is more information.
Yes.
That you can that can help bolster your arguments.
Yes. And
go for it.
No, please.
Oh no, I was just my question was
No, then wait for the question. Then I want to tell you something about history.
Tell me about it.
The only thing with history though that we have to be careful of is whose history, whose narrative, where is the information coming from what perspective? That's a challenging one because so even right now, we're in Christopher Columbus Day season, you know, everyone's talking about where did this holiday come from?
America's never done anything bad, right?
Right, exactly. You know, so with history, you're absolutely right. It is information when there is access to some kind of neutral, these are the facts, this is the direction of what happened without the coloring of, you know, whose narrative it is and whose narrative it's benefiting, you know, whose side it's, let's side, quote unquote, it's benefiting. And then I also wanted to push your metaphor further in saying that this same mentality is the same for human to human reactions. You know, when I have a partner and they're upset about something, but then I spend time with them understanding their childhood and vice versa. When I share painful moments in my own experience growing up, feeling bullied by other girls at school when I used to grow up in New York City, feeling bullied by my father at certain moments because he's like such a, excuse me, I'm going to sneeze.
Excuse me. Bless you.
Thank you. Overachieving, you know, kind of go-getter guy. Excuse me.
Again.
Let it out. You know, if we understand where some of our sensitivities come, our pain, our wounding, then not only can we proactively work on healing them, we can also let those in our life who are close to us understand where we come from and why something is difficult for us. So that even though they might be doing an action that to them is a normal action, but for us it might be a sensitive thing, they can be mindful to show up for us while we also do the work to heal those wounds. So that's history. It's exactly what you're saying. It's an opportunity for an understanding and empathy.
Can you think of the last time you changed your mind about something?
Yes. I mean, I stay trying to change my mind, or I stay trying to test what I like, what opinion I've tried on for size. You know, I stay trying to test the truth of it.
I like the idea of trying an opinion on for size.
Yeah.
So much.
Thank you.
So much. I mean, that's it, because it just adds a lightness to all of our opinions and these characters that we're playing in different times. Like, I was taking improv last year, and there's this...
I see that for you, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Appreciate it. Yeah, there's this exercise. Chris, who you know, Chris
Keener.
Who
I adore.
Aquarius. He is so damn good at improv. I bet. You ever want to really brighten your day, get Chris to do his characters for you.
Cool.
He has like 12 characters.
Well, I believe he's narrating my Mudwater collaboration.
His David Attenborough voice is just so one. Good. It's so good. But there was one class in improv where we were asked to go on stage and pretend that we were wearing a certain outfit and act from that outfit.
Cool.
And it gave us permission to be like, well, I'm going to be the camp counselor right now, or I'm going to be the president, or I'm all of this stuff. And the idea of just trying on opinions like their outfits creates a kind of
detachment as well.
Yeah, just good detachment and good naturedness about it all that I think is important.
I love that. I agree. And I'll do it with small things. And what I won't do it is do it publicly on my social media, though, because that feels irresponsible. So I'll do it like privately with my own friends, and I'll be like, I'm moving to London.
Yeah.
You know, and I'll just like, I'll see what hits and what doesn't hit. Like, someone will be like, either it'll be like, oh my God, I have the perfect place for you to stay, and also this and also that. Or like, oh my gosh, I have the best producer for you to meet out there. Or like, oh my God, have you tried this vegan restaurant? And then I'm like, oh, seems to be flowing. Maybe I am moving to London.
Right. How did it sound coming out of your lips?
Yep.
Like, you're like, I don't even know if I believe this, but I just want to say it. Like,
100.
No, that didn't work.
Or 100.
Like, wow, no, that felt good coming out.
Exactly. No, literally. That's how it's like echolocation. Like, what's bouncing back to you? I swear I do that. And I think my people who know me well enough are like, yeah, sure. I bet you are. And then they also know me well enough that like it might actually well be true. Or I might just move on to the next thing and try it on. And I think that's important. I think it's important for us to have safe spaces to workshop things that we may or may not be calling in.
It's the power of goodwill, right? If you have a friendship where you know there's a foundation of goodwill beneath it, you can try on different opinions. Mm. You can talk shit. You can kind of, because it's helping
it's
you. It's safe. Because you're just forming the thought with this person. And that's why I think those friendships are so damn important to have.
Mm.
And it's also very smart to not do it publicly as you're trying on the opinions
even,
for size.
Exactly. And even with my lyrics, with what I say in spaces like this, in spaces that I know I want my audience to like consume with trust, I really do spend a lot of time privately fostering my opinions, developing them, talking about them with people, expanding them. I mean, we never fully arrive, but I can tell when something feels healed, resolved, strong, and then I don't mind graduating it up to something I'm willing to share with like my full tenacity behind it. Like, this is a real thing that super works for me and I super believe in it. And I also give myself full space if 2-3 years change and I have a changed opinion, as you were asking me earlier. You know, Mahatma Gandhi used to really give the British a tough time because the British would come to Mahatma Gandhi in negotiating the independence of India and say, but Gandhi, 2 weeks ago you said this, now what? And Mahatma Gandhi would say, but I have 2 weeks more of information that I didn't have 2 weeks ago, so now my opinion has changed, letting in this new information, normal. And therefore, that's why this is the new bullet point that I'm asking for. And I think that's a very radical and important thing for us to give each other space to do. And we mentioned that earlier in the podcast. An opinion that I've changed recently. I can't think of one off the bat, but I'll be very vulnerable in sharing something that I'm just trying to work on, which is that I really love good clothes. I really love good clothes. I really love fashion. I really love going to the nicer shops and finding like one piece of something that I love love good jewelry, glasses, good shoes. I love good clothing. I love putting together an outfit. And I think I have to be self-aware and a little bit mindful of, when am I buying clothes? Am I buying it when I'm feeling a sense of lack, when I'm feeling a sense of like needing to shop? You know how we have all like addiction energies or like wanting to fulfill a need or a hole or a void in the wrong way, whether it's by overeating food or taking consumption or whatever. I think the radical opinion is like non-consumption and like finding abundance with the simplest pleasures and joys. On the other hand, as a creative, since I was a kid, clothing has been a huge source of my self-expression. I used to lay my outfit the night before just to feel excited to get out of bed to put the outfit on. And that's still true to this day. I always pack way more than I need for a trip so that when I arrive there, there's still some level of creativity based on the clothing that I've packed. So I think that's something that I'm working on. Like, I want to be mindful of when I'm shopping for the reason of an inadequacy, an insecurity, a void, and I'm not meeting the need in the right way. But I also want to honor the fact that I love celebrating creativity, clothing, showing up with an evolved sense of fashion every day almost. So that's something that, like, I don't know if I've changed my opinion on it, but I'm definitely trying to bring awareness to what's what.
Was there a moment that you decided yellow was going to be your color?
Since I was a kid, you know, my name is Kira.
Let me also say, I think more people should have theme colors. So if you feel that this is it's true, give people permission to have their own theme color too, because I think the world would be a much more interesting and, pun intended, colorful place.
I love this. It's never even, like, to me, it's so normal. Like, it's so true. I suppose it is a theme color. And when you say it like that, it almost feels funny to show up in your own team theme color.
You're on your own team.
Yeah, yeah. Like, go team. It does feel like that, and it is funny. And yet, in my own brain, I'm like, it's so normal. Like, yellow is my favorite color, so why wouldn't everything be yellow? Like, my phone is yellow, my car is yellow, my life is yellow, my loft is yellow. Like, to me, it's obvious. If it's available in yellow, I'm going to buy it. Like, it just that makes sense. My journal is yellow, my backpack is yellow. When I'm like, hey, can you pass me something from the yellow bag, like, someone will be like, okay, there's like six yellow bags here, like, which bag is it in? You know, this is quite a funny situation. Yeah, I mean, my name is Kieran, means ray of light. Since I was a kid, you know, I'd always be kind of given like yellows and sunshine colors, oranges, this kind of thing. I never really understood it as a kid. I liked that it was celebrated. I thought that was cool. And then I think it's just like I feel an auric feeling of goodness and light towards seeing yellows and golds, even sitting on this, like, you know, mustard chair. I love this chair. It feels like just a constant reminder to be the light, to go towards the light, to shine, to be shiny, to be loving, to be kind, to be vibrant. When I go into the sun and I feel the rays of the sun on my face, it's a warm, nice, life-affirming feeling. I want to be that for others, not let alone for myself. So this is where the yellow has deep significance.
Karen, this was such a blast.
Love.
That's our show. Before you head off into your day, click the link below and sign up for my Substack newsletter. Every Friday, I send one newsletter with a new word that I learned or think is cool, and write a little something about that word. So if you love growing your vocabulary, if you're the kind of weirdo who thinks that reading is sexy, click the link below or go to tierman.substack.com. That's tierman.substack.com to sign up for the weekly newsletter. Thank you to everyone who donates to this podcast via Substack. I rely on listeners like you to keep this thing going. So if you have some extra change, if this is the kind of thing that you want to support, I very much appreciate those paid subscriptions. And if you don't have the cash, just sign up for it for free. No big deal. Go be a good person. Get out into the water, whatever body of water is closest to you. Lake, river, bathtub, or ocean. I promise it will make your day better. See you soon.